From PRI, Public Radio International.
James's reading was a thing apart. An emanation of his inmost self, unaffected by fashion or elocutionary artifice. He read from his soul. And no one who never heard him read poetry knows what that soul was.
That was Brenda Wheel reading a sample from A Backward Glance by Edith Wharton, which we'll hear later in this program. This is Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story, and I'm Isaiah Sheffer, Artistic Director of Symphony Space on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where Selected Shorts originates. All the stories on this program were presented at The Mount, Edith Wharton's lovely house and gardens in the beautiful Berkshire Hills of Western Massachusetts. They were all part of a program celebrating the return of Edith Wharton's library to The Mount. Stephanie Copeland, the president of The Mount, spoke with us about this exciting acquisition and about Wharton's love of books.
Stephanie, just talk a little bit, if you would, about the importance of the library to Edith Wharton and the house.
Edith Wharton's best friends were books. She wrote in her autobiography, when she was a little girl, she received books as birthday presents. She woke up in the morning and there they were on her bedside table, and she said, "And I was never wholly alone again in my life." So to have her books, including the very books that she was referring to in this sentence, come back to the house she designed and built in Lenox, Massachusetts, is the most important thing that could happen for our effort. It brings the very soul of Edith Wharton to the project.
Oh, that's lovely. Can you talk a little bit about what's in the collection? What, other than, of course, the books of her friends, who were her favorite writers?
Oh, it's very interesting to see the collection of writers that she loved. Everyone from Proust to Stendhal, a lot of French writers. The Russians, she read the Russians in French, particularly Tolstoy. She loved Goethe, German. She read the Italians as well, and she read them in their own languages, except Russian. When she read a Russian, she read him in French.
You talked a little bit when we spoke last summer about how she used to entertain in the library and urge people to do readings. Can you kind of describe that phenomenon again?
When Edith Wharton collected her, as she called them, her inner circle of friends around her at the Mount, after dinner they would go to the library and they'd pull down book after book from the shelves and read from them. She loved to hear Henry James read. She encouraged him to read Walt Whitman, and in fact she's credited with developing in Henry James an appreciation of Walt Whitman by having him read it aloud. And the other thing that I thought was so interesting is that she said that Henry James had a stammer, and the only time it disappeared was when he was reading poetry.
I can't remember if that's something that's featured in the memoir we're actually using. Does she say that in the memoir?
Yes, she does. She writes about it in her chapter entitled Henry James, when she talks about her friendship with this incredibly interesting man, who she also said his friendship was the greatest honor in her life.
Well, it sounds as if this is the kind of experience that reminds people that libraries are dynamic spaces, not passive ones.
It's an extraordinary library.
And are you, in fact, literally reinstalling it in the room at this point?
Yes, we are. We're going book by book, looking at them very carefully, making note of all markings in the book, and also making notes of what condition the book is in. And then we are, of course, putting them on the shelves, the very shelves where many of these books once were.
That was Stephanie Copeland, president of The Mount. Now here's my reading of the first story we did on that program, Italo Calvino's A General in the Library. It's a story about military officers who are assigned to exercise some supervision and censorship at the National Library, but make some surprising discoveries instead. One day, in the illustrious nation of Panduria, a suspicion crept into the minds of top officials that books containing opinions hostile to military prestige existed. In fact, trials and inquiries had revealed that the tendency, now so widespread, of thinking of generals as people actually capable of making mistakes and causing catastrophes, and of wars as things that did not always amount to a splendid cavalry charge towards a glorious destiny, that suspicion was shared by a large number of books, ancient and modern, foreign and Pandurese. Panduria's general staff met together to assess the situation, but they didn't know where to begin because none of them was particularly well-versed in matters bibliographical. A commission of inquiry was set up under General Fedina, a severe and scrupulous official. The commission was to examine all the books in the biggest library in Panduria. The library was in an old building full of columns and staircases, the walls peeling and even crumbling here and there. Its cold rooms were crammed to bursting with books, and in parts inaccessible, with some corners only mice could explore. Weighed down by huge military expenditures, Panduria's state budget was unable to offer any assistance to libraries. The military took over the library one rainy morning in November. The general climbed off his horse, squat, stiff, his thick neck shaven, his eyebrows frowning over pince-nez. Four lanky lieutenants, chins held high and eyelids lowered, got out of a car, each with a briefcase in his hand. Then came a squadron of soldiers who set up camp in the old courtyard with mules, bales of hay, tents, cooking equipment, a camp radio, and signaling flags. Sentries were placed at the doors of the library, together with a notice forbidding entry for the duration of large-scale maneuvers now underway. This was an expedient which would allow the inquiry to be carried out in great secret. The scholars who used to go to the library every morning wearing heavy coats and scarves and balaclavas so as not to freeze had to go back home again. Puzzled, they asked each other, "What's this about large-scale maneuvers in the library? Won't they make a mess of the place? And the cavalry? And are they going to be shooting, too?" Of the library staff, only one little man, Signor Crispino, was kept so that he could explain to the officers how the books were arranged. He was a shortish fellow with a bald, eggish pate and eyes like pinheads behind his spectacles. First and foremost, General Fedina was concerned with the logistics of the operation, since his orders were that the commission was not to leave the library before having completed their inquiry. It was a job that required concentration, and they must not allow themselves to be distracted. Thus, a supply of provisions was procured, likewise some barrack stoves and a store of firewood, together with some collections of old, and it was generally thought, uninteresting magazines. Never had the library been so warm in the winter season. Pallet beds for the general and his officers were set up in safe areas surrounded by mouse traps. Then duties were assigned. Each lieutenant was allotted a particular branch of knowledge, a particular century of history. The general was to oversee the sorting of the volumes and the application of an appropriate rubber stamp, depending on whether a book had been judged suitable for officers, NCOs, common soldiers, or should be reported to the military court. After the commission began its appointed task, things got serious. Every evening, the camp radio transmitted General Fedina's report to HQ. So many books examined, so many seized as suspect, so many declared suitable for officers and soldiers. Only rarely were these cold figures accompanied by something out of the ordinary, a request for a pair of glasses to correct short-sightedness for an officer who had broken his, the news that a mule had eaten a rare manuscript edition of Cicero left unattended. But developments of far greater import were underway, about which the camp radio transmitted no news at all. Rather than thinning out, the forest of books seemed to grow ever more tangled and insidious. The officers would have lost their way had it not been for the help of Signor Crispino. Lieutenant Abrogati, for example, would jump to his feet and throw the book he was reading down on the table. "But this is outrageous! A book about the Punic Wars that speaks well of the Carthaginians and criticizes the Romans! This must be reported at once!" It should be said here that, rightly or wrongly, the Pandurians consider themselves descendants of the Romans. Moving silently in soft slippers, the old librarian came up to him. "That's nothing," he would say. "Read what it says here about the Romans again. You can put this in your report, too, and this, and this." And he presented him with a pile of books. The lieutenant leafed nervously through them. Then, getting interested, he began to read, to take notes. And he would scratch his head and mutter, "For heaven's sake, the things you learn! Who would ever have thought?" Signor Crispino went over to Lieutenant Lucchetti, who was closing a tome in rage, declaring, "Nice stuff this is. These people have the audacity to entertain doubts as to the purity of the ideals that inspired the Crusades." "Yes, sir, the Crusades." And Crispino said with a smile, "Oh, but look, if you have to make a report on that subject, may I suggest a few other books that will offer more details?" And he pulled down half a shelf full. Lieutenant Lucchetti leaned forward and got stuck in, and for a week you could hear him flicking through the pages and muttering, "These Crusades, though, very nice, I must say." In the commission's evening report, the number of books examined got bigger and bigger, but they no longer provided figures relative to positive and negative verdicts. General Fedina's rubber stamps lay idle. If, trying to check up on the work of one of the lieutenants, he asked, "But why did you pass this novel? The soldiers come off better than the officers. This author has no respect for hierarchy." The lieutenant would answer by quoting other authors and getting all muddled up in matters historical, philosophical, and economic. This led to open discussions that went on for hours and hours. Moving silently in his slippers, almost invisible in his gray shirt, Signor Crispino would always join in at the right moment, offering some book which he felt contained interesting information on the subject under consideration, and which always had the effect of radically undermining General Fedina's convictions. Meanwhile, the soldiers didn't have much to do and were getting bored. One of them, Barabasso, the best educated, asked the officers for a book to read. At first, they wanted to give him one of the few that had already been declared fit for the troops. But remembering the thousands of volumes still to be examined, the general was loath to think of Private Barabasso's reading hours being lost to the cause of duty. And he gave him a book yet to be examined, a novel that looked easy enough, suggested by Signor Crispino. Having read the book, Barabasso was to report to the general. Other soldiers likewise requested and were granted the same duty. Private Tomasone read aloud to a fellow soldier who couldn't read, and the man would give him his opinions. During open discussions, the soldiers began to take part along with the officers. Not much is known about the progress of the commission's work. What happened in the library through the long winter weeks was not reported. All we know is that General Fedina's radio reports to General Staff Headquarters became ever more infrequent until finally they stopped altogether. The chief of staff was alarmed. He transmitted the order to wind up the inquiry as quickly as possible and present a full and detailed report. In the library, the order found the minds of Fedina and his men prey to conflicting sentiments. On the one hand, they were constantly discovering new interests to satisfy and were enjoying their reading and studies more than they ever would have imagined. On the other hand, they couldn't wait to be back in the world again, to take up life again, a world and a life that seemed so much more complex now, as though renewed before their very eyes. And on yet another hand, the fact that the day was fast approaching when they would have to leave the library filled them with apprehension, for they would have to give an account of their mission. And with all the ideas that were now bubbling up in their heads, they had no idea how to get out of what had become a very tight corner indeed. In the evening, they would look out of the windows at the first buds on the branches growing in the sunset, at the lights going on in the town while one of them read some poetry out loud. Fedina wasn't with them. He had given the order that he was to be left alone at his desk to draft the final report. But every now and then, the bell would ring and the others would hear him calling, "Crispino! Crispino!" He couldn't get anywhere without the help of the old librarian, and they ended up sitting at the same desk, writing the report together. One bright morning, the commission finally left the library and went to report to the chief of staff. and Fadina illustrated the results of the enquiry before an assembly of the general staff. His speech was a kind of compendium of human history, from its origins down to the present day, a compendium in which all those ideas considered beyond discussion by the right-minded folk of Panduria were attacked, in which the ruling classes were declared responsible for the nation's misfortunes, and the people exalted as the heroic victims of mistaken policies and unnecessary wars. It was a somewhat confused presentation, including, as can happen with those who have only recently embraced new ideas, declarations that were often simplistic and contradictory. But as to the overall meaning, there could be no doubt. The assembly of generals was stunned. Their eyes opened wide. Then they found their voices had begun to shout. General Fadina was not even allowed to finish. There was talk of a court-martial, of his being reduced to the ranks. Then, afraid there might be a more serious scandal, the general and the four lieutenants were each pensioned off for health reasons as a result of, quote, serious nervous breakdown suffered in the course of duty. Dressed in civilian clothes with heavy coats and thick sweaters so as not to freeze, they were often to be seen going into the old library where Signor Crispino would be waiting for them with his books. That was yours truly reading Italo Calvino's A General in the Library. You can learn more about Selected Shorts in all its live and recorded incarnations at our website, selectedshorts.org. The second tale in our program of stories about libraries performed at the Mount is by the science fiction writer Ray Bradbury. It's called Exchange, and it's about a man who finds he can go home again. At least he can go home to his childhood library, where he meets the wonderful character of the librarian, who's your fantasy of a dream librarian from your childhood who remembers all your favorite books. The wonderful actress Rochelle Oliver reads Ray Bradbury's Exchange.
There were too many cards in the file, too many books on the shelves, too many children laughing in the children's room, too many newspapers to fold and stash on the racks. All in all, too much. Miss Adams pushed her gray hair back over her lined brow, adjusted her gold-rimmed pince-nez, and rang the small silver bell on the library desk, at the same time switching off and on all the lights. The exodus of adults and children was exhausting. Miss Ingram, the assistant librarian, had gone home early because her father was sick, so it left the burden of stamping, filing, and checking books squarely on Miss Adams' shoulders. Finally, the last book was stamped, the last child fed through the great brass doors, the doors locked, and with immense weariness, Miss Adams moved back up through a silence of 40 years of books and being keeper of the books, stood for a long moment by the main desk. She laid her glasses down on the green blotter and pressed the bridge of her small bone nose between thumb and forefinger and held it, eyes shut. What a racket. Children who finger-painted or cartooned frontispieces or rattled their roller skates. High school students arriving with laughters, departing with mindless songs. Taking up her rubber stamp, she probed the files, weeding out errors, her fingers whispering between Dante and Darwin. A moment later, she heard the rapping on the front door glass and saw a man's shadow outside wanting in. She shook her head. The figure pleaded silently, making gestures. Sighing, Miss Adams opened the door, saw a young man in uniform, and said, "It's late. We're closed." She glanced at his insignia and added, "Captain." "Hold on," said the captain. "Remember me?" And repeated it as she hesitated. "Remember?" She studied his face, trying to bring light out of shadow. "Yes, I think I do," she said at last. "You once borrowed books here." "Right. Many years ago," she added. "Now I almost have you placed." As he stood waiting, she tried to see him in those other years, but his younger face did not come clear or a name with it, and his hand reached out now to take hers. "May I come in?" "Well," she hesitated, "yes." She led the way up the steps into the immense twilight of books. The young officer looked around and let his breath out slowly, then reached to take a book and hold it to his nose, inhaling, then almost laughing. "Don't mind me, Miss Adams. You ever smell new books? Binding, pages, print, like fresh bread when you're hungry." He glanced around. "I'm hungry now, but I don't even know what for." There was a moment of silence, so she asked him how long he might stay. "Just a few hours. I'm on the train from New York to L.A., so I came up from Chicago to see old places, old friends." His eyes were troubled, and he fretted his cap, turning it in his long, slender fingers. She said gently, "Is anything wrong? Anything I can help you with?" He glanced out the window at the dark town with just a few lights in the windows of the small houses across the way. "I was surprised," he said. "By what?" "Well, I don't know what I expected. Pretty damn dumb," he said, looking from her to the windows, "to expect that when I went away, everyone froze in place, waiting for me to come home. That when I stepped off the train, all my old pals would unfreeze, run down, meet me at the station. Silly." "No," she said, more easily now. "I think we all imagined that. I visited Paris as a young girl, went back to France when I was 40, and was outraged that no one had waited. Buildings had vanished, and all the hotel staff where I had once lived had died, retired, or traveled." He nodded at this, but could not seem to go on. "Did anyone know you were coming?" she asked. "Well, I wrote a few, but no answers. I figured, hell, they're busy, but they'll be there." They weren't. She felt the next words come off her lips and was faintly surprised. "I'm still here," she said. "You are," he said with a quick smile, "and I can't tell you how glad I am." He was gazing at her now with such intensity that she had to look away. "You know," she said, "I must confess you look familiar, but I don't quite fit your face with the boy who came here 20 years ago. And as for what he looked like, that other one, me, well," he brought out a smallish wallet which held a dozen pictures and handed over a photograph of a boy, perhaps 12 years old, with an impish smile and wild blonde hair, looking as if he might catapult out of the frame. "Ah, yes," Miss Adams adjusted her pince-nez and closed her eyes to remember that one. "Spaulding. William Henry Spaulding." He nodded and peered at the picture in her hands anxiously. "Was I a lot of trouble?" "Yes," she nodded and held the picture closer and glanced up at him. "A fiend." She handed the picture back. "But I loved you." "Did you?" he said and smiled more broadly. "In spite of you, yes." He waited a moment and then said, "Do you still love me?" She looked to left and right as if the dark stacks held the answer. "It's a little early to know, isn't it?" "Forgive. No, no, a good question. Time will tell. Let's not stand like your frozen friends who didn't move. Come along. I've just had some late-night coffee. There may be some left. Give me your cap. Take off that coat. The file index is there. Go look up your old library cards for the hell of the heck of it." "Are they still there?" in a maze. "Librarians save everything. You never know who's coming in on the next train. Go." When she came back with the coffee, he stood staring down into the index file like a bird fixing its gaze on a half-empty nest. He handed her one of the old purple-stamped cards. "My God," he said, "I took out a lot of books. 10 at a time. I said no, but you took them and," she added, "read them here." She put his cup on top of the file and waited while he drew out canceled card after card and laughed quietly. I can't believe I must not have lived anywhere else but here. May I take this with me to sit? He showed the card. She nodded. Can you show me around? I mean, maybe I've forgotten something. She shook her head and took his elbow. I doubt that. Come on. Over here, of course, is the adult section. I begged you to let me cross over when I was 13. You're not ready, you said, but I let you cross over anyway. You did, and much thanks. Another thought came to him as he looked down at her. You used to be taller than me, he said. She looked up at him, amused. I've noticed that happens quite often in my life, but I can still do this. Before he could move, she grabbed his chin in her thumb and forefinger and held tight. His eyes rolled. He said, I remember when I was really bad, you'd hold on and put your face down close and scowl. The scowl did it. After 10 seconds of your holding my chin very tight, I behaved for days. She nodded, released his chin. He rubbed it, and as they moved on, he ducked his head, not looking at her. Forget. I hope you won't be upset, but when I was a boy, I used to look up and see you behind your desk, so near, but far away. And how can I say this? I used to think that you were Mrs. God, and that the library was a whole world, and that no matter what part of the world or what people or thing I wanted to see and read, you'd find it and give it to me. He stopped, his face coloring. You did, too. You had the world ready for me every time I asked. There was always a place I hadn't seen, a country I hadn't visited, where you took me. I've never forgotten. She looked around slowly at the thousands of books. She felt her heart move quietly. Did you really call me what you just said? Mrs. God? Oh, yes, often, always. Come along, she said at last. They walked around the rooms together and then downstairs to the newspaper files, and coming back up, he suddenly leaned against the banister, holding tight. Miss Adams, he said. What is it, Captain? He exhaled. I'm scared. I don't want to leave. I'm afraid. Her hand, all by itself, took his arm, and she finally said, there in the shadows, sometimes I'm afraid, too. What frightens you? I don't want to go away without saying goodbye. If I never return, I want to see all my friends, shake hands, slap them on the back, I don't know, make jokes. He stopped and waited, then went on, but I walk around town, and nobody knows me. Everyone's gone. The pendulum on the wall clock slid back and forth, shining with the merest of sounds. Hardly knowing where she was going, Miss Adams took his arm and guided him up the last steps away from the marble vaults below to a final brightly decorated room where he glanced around and shook his head. There's no one here either. Do you believe that? Well, where are they? Do any of my old pals ever come visit, borrow books, bring them back late? Not often, she said, but listen, do you realize Thomas Wolfe was wrong? Wolfe, the great literary beast, wrong? The title of one of his books, You Can't Go Home Again, he guessed. That's it. He was wrong. This is home. Your friends are still here. This was your summer place. Yes. Myths, legends, mummies, Aztec kings, wicked sisters who spat toads, where I really lived, but I don't see my people. Well, and before he could speak, she switched on a green-shaded lamp that shed a private light on a small table. Isn't this nice, she said. Most libraries today, much, much too light. There should be shadows, don't you think? Some mystery, yes? So that late nights the beasts can prowl out of the stacks and crouch by this jungle light to turn the pages with their breath. Am I crazy? Not that I noticed. Good, sit. Now that I know who you are, it all comes back. It couldn't possibly. No, you'll see. She vanished into the stacks and came out with 10 books that she placed upright, their pages a trifle spread so they could stand and he could read the titles. The summer of 1930, when you were, what, 10? You read all of these in 1 week. Oz, Dorothy, the Wizard, oh, yes. She placed still others nearby. Alice in Wonderland, Through the Looking Glass. A month later, you reborrowed both. But I said, you've already read them. But you said, not enough so I can speak. I want to be able to tell them out loud. My God, he said quietly, did I say that? You did. Here's more you read a dozen times. Greek myths, Roman, Egyptian, Norse myths, Chinese. You were ravenous. King Tut arrived from the tomb when I was 3. His picture in the rotogravure started me. What else have you there? Tarzan of the Apes. You borrowed it 3 dozen times. John Carter, Warlord of Mars, 4 dozen. My God, dear lady, how come you remember all this? You never left. Summertimes you were here when I unlocked the doors. You went home for lunch, but sometimes brought sandwiches and sat out by the Stone Lion at noon. Your father pulled you home by your ear some nights when you stayed late. How could I forget a boy like that? But still, you never played. Never ran out in baseball weather or football. I imagine why. He glanced toward the front door. They were waiting for me. They. You know, the ones who never borrowed books, never read. They, them, those. She looked and remembered. Ah, yes. The bullies. Why did they chase you? Because they knew I loved books and didn't much care for them. It's a wonder you survived. I used to watch you getting reading hunchbacked late afternoons. You looked so lonely. No, I had these, company. Here's more. She put down Ivanhoe, Robin Hood, and Treasure Island. Oh, he said, and dear and strange Mr. Poe, how I loved his Red Death. You took it so often, I told you to keep it on permanent loan unless someone else asked. Someone did 6 months later, and when you brought it in, I could see it was a terrible blow. A few days later, I let you have Poe for another year. I don't recall. Did you ever? Oh, it's out in California. Shall I? No. No. Please. Well, here are your books. Let me bring others. She came out, not carrying many books, but one at a time, as if each one were indeed special. She began to make a circle inside the other Stonehenge circle, and as she placed the books in lonely splendor, he said their names, and then the names of the authors who had written them, and then the names of those who had sat across from him so many years ago and read the books quietly, or sometimes whispered the finest parts out loud so beautifully that no one said quiet or silence or even shh. She placed the first book, and there was a wild field of broom and a wind blowing a young woman across that field as it began to snow, and someone far away called Kathy, and as the snows fell, he saw a girl he had walked to school in the 6th grade, seated across the table, her eyes fixed to the wind-blown field and the snow and the lost woman in another time of winter. A second book was set in place, and a black and beauteous horse raced across a summer field of green, and on that horse was another girl who hid behind the book and dared to pass him notes when he was 12. And then there was the far ghost with a snow maiden face whose hair was a long golden harp played by the summer airs, she who was always sailing to Byzantium where emperors were drowsed by golden birds that sang in clockwork cages at sunset and dawn. She who always skirted the outer rim of school and went to swim in the deep lake 10,000 afternoons ago and never came out, so was never found. But now, suddenly, she made landfall here in the green-shaded light and opened Yates to at last sail home from Byzantium. And on her right, John Huff, whose name came clearer than the rest, who claimed to have climbed every tree in town and fallen from none, who had raced through watermelon patches, treading melons, never touching earth, to knock down rainfalls of chestnuts with one blow, who yodeled at your sun-up window and wrote the same Mark Twain book report in four different grades. Before the teachers caught on, at which he said, vanishing, "Just call me Huck." And to his right, the pale son of the town hotel owner, who looked as if he had gone sleepless forever, who swore every empty house was haunted and took you there to prove it with a juicy tongue, compressed nose, and throat garglings that sounded the long October demise, the terrible and unutterable fall of the house of Usher. And next to him was yet another girl, and next to her, and just beyond. Miss Adams placed a final book, and he recalled the fair creature long ago, when such things were left unsaid, glancing up at him one day when he was an unknowing 12 and she was a wise 13, to quietly say, "I am beauty, and you? Are you the beast?" Now, late in time, he wanted to answer that small and wondrous ghost. No, he hides in the stacks, and when the clock strikes three, will prowl forth to drink. And it was finished. All the books were placed, the outer ring of his selves, and the inner ring of remembered faces, deathless with summer and autumn names. He sat for a long moment, and then another long moment, and then one by one reached for and took all of the books that had been his and still were, and opened them and read and shut them, and took another until he reached the end of the outer circle, and then went to touch and turn and find the raft on the river, the field of broom where the storms lived, and the pasture with a black and beauteous horse and its lovely rider. Behind him, he heard the lady librarian quietly back away to leave him with words. A long while later, he sat back, rubbed his eyes, and looked around at the fortress, the encirclement, the Roman encampment of books, and nodded, his eyes wet. "Yes," he heard her move behind him. "Yes, what? What you said, Thomas Wolfe? The title of that book of his? Wrong. Everything's here. Nothing's changed." "Nothing will, as long as I can help it," she said. "Don't ever go away." "I won't, if you'll come back more often." Just then, from below the town, not so very far off, a train whistle blew. She said, "Is that yours?" "No, but the one soon after," he said, and got up and moved around the small monuments that stood very tall, and one by one shut the covers, his lips moving to sound the old titles and the old dear names. "Do we have to put them back on the shelves?" he said. She looked at him and at the double circle and after a long moment said, "Tomorrow will do." "Why?" "Maybe," he said, "during the night, because of the color of those lamps, green, the jungle, maybe those creatures you mentioned will come out and turn the pages with their breath, and maybe, what else? Maybe my friends who've hidden the stacks all these years will come out, too." "They're already here," she said quietly. "Yes," he nodded, "they are." And still he could not move. She backed off across the room without making any sound, and when she reached her desk, she called back the last call of the night. Closing time, children, and turned the lights quickly off and then on and then halfway between, a library twilight. He moved from the table with the double circle of books and came to her and said, "I can go now." "Yes," she said, "William Henry Spaulding, you can." They walked together as she turned out the lights one by one. She helped him into his coat, and then, hardly thinking to do so, he took her hand and kissed her fingers. It was so abrupt, she almost laughed. But then she said, remember what Edith Wharton said when Henry James did what you just did. What? The flavor starts at the elbow. They broke into laughter together, and he turned and went down the marble steps toward the stained glass entry. At the bottom of the stairs, he looked up at her and said, "Tonight, when you're going to sleep, remember what I called you when I was 12 and say it out loud." "I don't remember," she said. "Yes, you do." Below the town, a train whistle blew again. He opened the front door, stepped out. And he was gone. Her hand on the last light switch, looking in at the double circle of books on the far table, she thought, "What was it he called me? Oh, yes," she said a moment later, and switched off the light.
We've been listening to Rochelle Oliver reading Ray Bradbury's story, Exchange. You are listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Our final selection from the program of stories about libraries performed at Edith Wharton's home, The Mount, is a story about that house and that library. It's called A Backward Glance, Henry James. Edith Wharton used to gather friends in her library, and they'd sit around and read to each other, and one of those friends was the great American writer Henry James. Brenda Wheel, who was featured in David Hare's play Stuff Happens, reads A Backward Glance, Henry James.
It is perhaps best to put Henry James' name first on the list of the friends who composed my closest group during the years I spent at the Mount and those that followed. In fact, however, my first meeting with Henry James happened many years earlier, probably in the late 80s, though it is at the Mount that he first comes into the foreground of the picture. On his first visit, he was in fairly good health and in excellent spirits, exhilarated at first by the novelty of the adventure, the success of his revolt against his own sedentary habit. He called me the pendulum woman because I crossed the Atlantic every year, and above all, captivated by the new experience of motoring. In spite of many frustrations, there were beautiful tours successfully carried out in the Wharton's commodious new motor, which has fairly converted me to the sense of all the thing may do for one and one may get from it. And this mode of locomotion seemed to him, as it had to me, an immense enlargement of life. Henry James' memory for a joke was prodigious. When he got hold of a good one, he not only preserved it piously, but raised upon it an intricate superstructure of kindred nonsense, into which every addition offered by a friend was skillfully incorporated. Into his nonsense world, as four-dimensional as that of the looking glass or the land where the Jumblies live, the reader could hardly have groped his way without a preparatory course in each correspondent's private history and casual experience. The merest hint was usually enough to fire the train. And, as in the writing of his tales, a tiny mustard seed of illusion spread into a many-branched subject, so his best nonsense flowered out of unremembered trifles. Sometimes his chaff was not untinged with malice. I remember a painful moment during one of his visits when my husband imprudently blurted out an allusion to Edith's new story. You've seen it in the last Scribner? My heart sank. I knew it always embarrassed James to be called on in the author's presence for an appreciation. He was himself so engrossed in questions of technique and construction, and so increasingly detached from the short story form as a medium, that very few fictions, as he called them, but his own, were of interest to him. Except indeed H.G. Wells, for which he once avowed to me an incurable liking, because everything he writes is so alive and kicking. At any rate, I always tried to keep my own work out of his way, and once accused him of ferreting out and reading it just to annoy me, to which charge his sole response was a guilty chuckle. In the present instance, as usual, he instantly replied, "Oh, yes, my dear Edward, I've read the little work. Of course I've read it." A gentle pause, which I knew boded no good. Then he softly continued, "Admirable, admirable, a masterly little achievement." He turned to me, full of a terrifying benevolence. "Of course, so accomplished a mistress of the art would not, without deliberate intention, have given the tale so curiously conventional a treatment, though indeed in the given case no treatment but the conventional was possible, which might conceivably, my dear lady, on further consideration have led you to reject your subject as in itself a totally unsuitable one." He knew I enjoyed our literary rough and tumbles. One of our joys, when the talk touched on any great example of prose or verse, was to get the book from the shelf and ask one of the company to read the passage aloud. Now, there were some admirable readers in the group in whose gift I had long delighted, but I had never heard Henry James read aloud or known that he enjoyed doing so. Till one night, someone alluded to Emily Bronte's poems, and I said I had never read Remembrance. Immediately, he took the volume from my hand, and his eyes filling, and some faraway emotion deepening his rich and flexible voice, he began. "Cold in the earth, and the deep snow piled above thee, far, far removed, cold in the dreary grave, have I forgot my only love to love thee, severed at last by time's all-severing wave?" I had never before heard poetry read as he read it, and I never have since. He chanted it, and he was not afraid to chant it, as many good readers are, who, though they instinctively feel that the genius of the English poetical idiom requires it to be spoken as poetry, are yet afraid of yielding to their instinct, because the present-day fashion is to chatter high verse as though it were colloquial prose. James, on the contrary, far from shirking the rhythmic emphasis, gave it full expression. His stammer ceased as if by magic, as soon as he began to read, and his ear, so sensitive to the convolutions of an intricate prose style, never allowed him to falter over the most complex prosody, but swept him forward on great rollers of sound till the full weight of his voice fell on the last cadence. James's reading was a thing apart, an emanation of his inmost self, unaffected by fashion or elocutionary artifice. He read from his soul, and no one who never heard him read poetry knows what that soul was. Another day, someone spoke of Whitman, and it was a joy to me to discover what James thought of him, as I did, the greatest of American poets. Leaves of Grass was put into his hands, and all that evening we sat rapt while he wandered from The Song of Myself to When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed. When he read Lovely and Soothing Death, His voice filled the hushed room like an organ adagio. And thence let himself be lured on to the mysterious music of Out of the Cradle, reading, or rather crooning it in a mood of subdued ecstasy till the fivefold invocation to death tolled out like the knocks in the opening bars of the Fifth Symphony. James's admiration of Whitman, his immediate response to that mighty appeal, was a new proof of the way in which, above a certain level, the most divergent intelligences walk together like gods. We talked long that night of leaves of grass tossing back and forth to each other, treasure after treasure. But finally, James, in one of his sudden humorous drops from the heights, flung up his hands and cried out with the old stammer and twinkle, "Oh, yes, a great genius, undoubtedly a very great genius, only one cannot help deploring his too extensive acquaintance with the foreign languages." I believe James enjoyed those days at the Mount as much as he did or could anything connected with the American scene. And the proof of it is the length of his visits and their frequency. But on one occasion, his stay with us coincided with a protracted heat wave. We discovered that the only panacea was incessant motoring. Luckily, by that time, we had a car which really would go. And go we did, daily, incessantly, over miles and miles of lustrous landscape lying motionless under the still glaze of heat. While we were moving, he was refreshed and happy. His spirits rose, the twinkle returned to his lips and eyes, and we never halted except for tea on a high hillside or for a cooling drink at a village apothecary's, on one of which occasions he instructed one of us to bring him something less innocent than Apollinaris, and was enchanted when this was interpreted as meaning an orange phosphate, a most sophisticated beverage for that day. On another afternoon, we had camped for tea on a mossy ledge in the shade of great trees, and as he seemed less uneasy than usual, somebody pulled out an anthology, and I asked one of the party to read aloud Swinburne's Triumph of Time, which I knew to be a favorite of James. But after a stanza or two, I saw the twinkle of beatitude fade, and an agonized hand was lifted up. Perhaps in view of the abnormal state of the weather, our young friend could have done better to choose a poem of less inordinate length. And immediately we were all bundled back into the car and started off again on the incessant quest for air. Those long days at the Mount, in the deep summer glow, or the crisp glitter of autumn, walks in the woods, motor flights over hill and dale, evening talks on the moonlit terrace, and readings around the library fire come back with a mocking radiance as I write. In one respect, Henry James stood alone among the great talkers I've known, for while he was inexhaustible in repartee and never had the least tendency to monopolize the talk, yet it was really in monologue that he was most himself. I remember, in particular, one summer evening when we sat late on the terrace at the Mount with the lake shining palely through the dark trees, and one of us suddenly said to him, in response to some chance allusion to his Albany relations, "And now tell us about the Emmetts. Tell us all about them." The Emmett and Temple families composed, as we knew, the main element of his vast and labyrinthine cousinship, the Emmetry, as he called it. And for a moment he stood there, brooding in the darkness, murmuring over to himself, "Ah, my dear, the Emmetts, ah, the Emmetts." Then he began, forgetting us, forgetting the place, forgetting everything but the vision of his lost youth that the question had evoked. A long train of ghosts flung with his enchanter's wand across the wide stage of the summer night. Ghost-like indeed at first, wavering and indistinct, they glimmered at us through a series of disconnected ejaculations, epithets, allusions, parenthetical rectifications and restatements, till not only our brains, but the clear night itself seemed filled with a palpable fog. And then, suddenly, by some miracle of shifted lights and accumulated strokes, there they stood before us, as they lived. Drawn with a million filament-like lines, yet sharp as an Ingres, dense as a Rembrandt, or, to call upon his own art for an analogy, minute and massive as the people of Balzac. I often saw the trick repeated, saw figures obscure or famous summoned to the white square of his magic lantern, flickering and wavering there, and slowly solidifying under the turn of his lens. But never, perhaps, anything so ample, so sustained, as that summoning to life of dead and gone Emmets and Temples, old lovelinesses, old follies, old failures, all long laid away and forgotten under old crumbling gravestones. He had always clung to his cousinage and to anyone who represented old friendly associations, whether in Albany, New York, or Boston. And I remember his once saying, "You see, my dear, they're so much easier to talk to because I can always ask them questions about uncles and aunts and other cousins." He had brought this question-asking system to a high state of perfection and practiced it not only on relations and old friends, but on transatlantic pilgrims to Lamb House, whom he would literally silence by a friendly volley of interrogations as to what train they had taken to come down, and whether they had seen all the cathedral towns yet, and what plays they had done, so that they went away aglow with the great man's cordiality. "And, you see, my dear, they hadn't time to talk to me about my books." The calamity at all costs to be averted.
That was A Backward Glance, Henry James, read by Brenda Wheel. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2007 by Stephen King, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is given by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund in the New York Community Trust, the Henry Nias Foundation, the Axe Houghton Foundation, the Arthur Foundation, and members of the Symphony Space Literature Producers Circle. Public funds come from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art, and the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.